Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Shankelberg, and James Kovacevic is joining me once again. Hey, James.
Hi, Fred. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I wanted to talk to you because I got a question the other day, and it was along the lines of my desire. I was walking through a hardware store. My wife and I were picking up a few running errands and stuff, and I saw a Craftsman set of tools. And we've been doing a bunch of stuff around the house, and one of them was we had a kind of a makeshift old set of tools that we didn't have quite the right crescent wrench, and the socket was kind of a bunch of adapters to connect it all together and stuff. And so I made the point that a good set of tools, and I don't know if it's debatable anymore or not whether Craftsman's a good set of tools or if I should go with some other brand, but you know, get a good tool set as an investment rather than buying them individually will help us save time in the future. And, you know, gives me that, really? You know, you're going to have to justify this kind of thing. So we kept moving. But I was thinking the same thing applies in a factory, right? Is if your team is in Home Depot or at the hardware store half the time looking for parts, and looking for tools, they're not on your shop floor fixing things. And
absolutely.
So, you know, so there is some investment that will help you to get a minimum, reliability and maintenance program. But then there's probably a little bit more to make it really good. And my question, my thought was in walking through this hardware store the other day, well, what's the right investment? I mean, obviously, I don't need to buy the entire suite of all mechanical and hardware and home appliance type tools that's made to man. Yet, I probably do need a good socket set and wrench set. But what's the right balance?
So that's a tricky question. And it all depends upon where your maturity level is in the organization. If you're just starting out, obviously, you're going to have more upfront costs. But as you get more mature, you're going to bring that down. And if I think back to a great presentation I sat through with Ron Moore, he called it the bow wave effect. Mm-hmm. So in order to make maintenance and reliability programs effective, you have to invest a little. And yep, you're going to get that little bow wave increasing cost, but then it's going to come down. And then you invest a little bit more again, and it's going to come down even further.
Well, you said come down. It's the ongoing costs, like your staff stocking and all kinds of other things will be high initially, but then the recurring costs will taper off.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So it's a tricky situation depending on where you're at. If you're very highly reactive, obviously you need to invest in not just tools, but resources, spares, training, and you know, the time to go through and do the right analysis, do those failure mode effect analysis, do the PM optimization, do that work. So you're making sure you're doing the right work. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy thing to put a number to, but if you're best in class on average, you're going to spend roughly 3% or less on maintenance per year as a percentage of the total replacement value of that site.
Hmm. Where's that number come from?
So that is an SMRP benchmark. And obviously if you're a process-based facilities such as petrochemical refining, that cost is going to come down. Mm-hmm. But if you're in something like mining, it might be a little bit higher, but generally 3%, 2.5 to 3% percentage replacement value of the site is what you're aiming for.
Okay. So that, I mean, that at least puts a mark out there of what to expect. But well, what kind of things? I'm thinking of just my tools kit, you know, is how do you decide how much to spend to start and where do you spend it? Is it because my response was basically we were in the hardware store looking for a tool to, you know, set of screws and an ability to tap a bolt that had been stripped. And so I was, yeah, I could get that, but that's very reactionary, right? I get what I need and then store it, as opposed to grab the entire kit.
Yeah. So that all starts from the organizational level. You have to establish what those organizational goals are. And I think we talked about this previously, mm-hmm. But you have to know, what does the organization expect from that facility? Is it so many hundred tons per day? Is it so many cases per day? Is it so many widgets per day? Whatever that number is. Mm-hmm. And then you got to break that down to, what is the equipment capable of performing? What level do we need to maintain that equipment at? Once we establish that level, then we can start looking at, okay, here's the criticality ranking. We're going to establish what maintenance we're going to do on what pieces of equipment now. So we need to invest in the people to do the failure mode effect analysis, the PM optimization, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. From that, now we're going to know what parts we expect to fail, and we're going to use a run to failure approach. What ones we want to keep on hand for that insurance case. And then once we understand all that work we need to do, now we can start sizing the department appropriately. Do we have enough mechanics to do all this work? Do we have the support functions behind that? The right level of people in the storeroom, your reliability engineers, your maintenance engineers, your supervisors, your predictive or condition-based maintenance analysts, mm-hmm, all those mm-hmm. things.
Well, I can see where the bow wave comes from, because you're, one, keeping the plant operating while you're doing a bunch of extra studies and essential studies, so that you can invest correctly. I think that's where I've seen pushback is, hey, we're just trying to keep the plant running. What do we need to do? Well, it's not like you can walk in the door and say, oh, you need to do this, this, and this. You need eight, you know, mechanics, and you need so many electricians, and you need, I think, going through the investment, and that's really what it is what you're talking about, is to sort out what is your maintenance strategy for your major assets, and what are you working on the right ones? I think it also brings up the question is, do you have the capacity that will help you actually achieve your objectives? More of a business situation. If your equipment is only capable of running at, say, 90% availability, you can do the math and figure out whether you're going to make it or not to your capacity.
Exactly. And that's why I find specialists such as yourself come into play. Organizations aren't going to hire someone to do failure mode effect analysis for the rest of their career. Mm-hmm. Some will, but most manufacturing organizations won't. So that's where they bring in someone such as yourself.
You can do this.
And we facilitate these analysis, and we demonstrate the return on one or two. You start that pilot program, you do the one or two, you demonstrate the savings, the improvements you see, not only in the availability of those assets, but also cost savings, less spares, less time, all those other aspects that go into a properly structured maintenance program.
That's right.
Once you demonstrate that, then you can start going after other pieces of equipment. So you use the specialists, but you want to make sure when you're using those specialists that they're training someone in-house to eventually take over. Because as you start reducing the time to do all this maintenance work, reducing costs, you're going to start freeing up some of your guys internally. So pick your champion, get him involved, and use him to help facilitate these down the road.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then as you modify your plant, or you bring on new equipment, or you go deeper into your asset base, you continue to make savings and continue to benefit from it.
Yep. Now,
so it's still not helping me figure out.
Now there is another way to look at it too. So that is, you know, the technical proper way to kind of structure that. Mm-hmm. If we don't have those resources and there's not that ambition to do that within an organization, there's some rules of thumb you can use. For example, typically if your facility for a facility, if it's worth, say, I don't know, $8 million, okay, equipment and everything, typically you need one maintenance guy. It's a rule of thumb anywhere from $6 to $8 million per tradesman. So you have that. You also have some for maintenance planners / schedulers. Mm-hmm. Anywhere from, depending on how mature your planning organization is, anywhere from 15 to 25 trades per planner. You want one maintenance supervisor per 8 to 10 mechanics, roughly, mm-hmm, right? And then, you know, smaller organizations, you may have someone who serves a role as a maintenance engineer / reliability engineer. Mm-hmm. You get more people. Larger organizations, you have two distinct roles. If you have a condition monitoring program, you have your CBM analyst and that sort of thing. So there's some rules of thumbs out there for that sort of thing. Same thing with spare parts. I'm trying to remember if it's 2,000 or 4,000 SKUs per storeroom individual.
Okay.
So the SMRP best practice guidelines have some of these directly in them. How many indirect to direct maintenance staff you should have, how many SKUs per store person, planner to craft, team leads or supervisors to craft. They have that in there.
And that gives you an idea if you're setting up a shop or you want to just get a benchmark, basically, is, you know, what's the right level to be at.
Yes.
But it's not best in class. It's not tailored to your particular industry. So it's a starting point and gives you something to start with and to move from.
Yeah. And you can't just take it at face value. You have to understand your organization, their current goals, their future goals, all those things. If this is a facility where we know we're going to run for 2 years and they're shutting it down and building a brand new one next door, obviously our approach is going to be dramatically different, and we're not going to staff those reliability engineers or maintenance engineers because we really don't care about the long-term reliability of it. That's because right. It's being shut down. So you have to understand that context, and you also have to understand your industry. Obviously pharmaceuticals, you know, biopharma, you have a lot of regulations you need to adjust for and a lot of things you need to do. So you're typically going to be a little bit more heavy in that aspect.
Well, right? Just the paperwork, if nothing else.
Exactly. So you got all those things you got to consider. So there's no hard and fast rule. It's a starting point to hopefully get that there. But what's worse is if you don't invest at all.
Right? If you set up and just get the reactionary force, basically, that's still considered an investment by some. It's, you know, the bare minimum to get you going, but that bow wave now turns into a plow. You're just pushing those costs out in front of you.
Yeah. And then, you know, people do cost cutting things like cut back on overtime they're not doing the preventative maintenance because they're not getting the time, and it just spirals and spirals and spirals, right?
Yeah. Vicious circle kind of thing. Whereas by sorting out the maintenance strategy and investing properly, you end up with that virtuous cycle. Now, one of the hard parts that I find when you do have a team that gets it started and starts showing the benefit, it shows invisible benefits. What I mean by that is that by avoiding downtime, it doesn't show up as being a problem. Right. The downtime is everybody's up in arms. We don't like that. We got to get fixed. We have heroes show up and everybody, you know, celebrates and we're up and running again. And you get a lot of attention. But when it's working as expected or better, and it's generating cost avoidance by avoiding unnecessary spares and avoiding unnecessary downtime, the preventative maintenance team is doing its job. They're not visible. They become unseen heroes to some respect. And so part of the investment's got to go also to how do you maintain the visibility of the actual benefit that investment is creating?
Yeah. And one of the things I've seen work very well is if you have that condition-based maintenance or predictive maintenance analyst or reliability engineer or someone like that, what they do is if they detect an anomaly occurring through your monitoring program and so on and so forth, what they'll do is they'll obviously implement the preventative action to stop that failure from actually becoming a functional failure and interrupting the process. They'll do all that stuff, plan it, schedule it, you know, what we're supposed to do. But they take it one step further. They use the history that they have or an understanding of the equipment and create an estimated length of downtime plus part cost plus labor cost, all these things. And they put that next to what they did, that plan job. So we didn't have to expedite parts. We didn't have to run overtime. We didn't have to do all those amazing things. And they can demonstrate. So here's what it would have cost us, a reactive standpoint. Here's what it would cost, what it did cost us from a plan standpoint. But then here's how much downtime you would have incurred at whatever that line or that equipment was producing per hour.
Right.
So that way that.
Yeah, it becomes visible then.
Exactly. And what I've seen is some organizations do, and it's absolutely amazing when you see this, down their main hallway when you walk in, they have one of those glass cases there.
Right.
and they have those parts that were damaged in there with the savings that occurred because they caught it before it stopped the production line.
Oh, it's like a trophy case, but it's a preventative message rather than a reactive message.
Exactly. And it shows right there how much downtime costs, everything that was saved as a result of that catch. Mm-hmm. So it's visible to everyone. And the buy-in that that creates is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah. And you know, that doesn't cost hardly anything to do, to celebrate the preventative maintenance type of activity. Bulletin board. Yeah.
Yeah. It takes that engineer, you know, an extra hour per that job to formulate all those costs and whatever. But you know, one of those savings more than justifies that engineer for the year.
Yeah.
Typically.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's one way that can help that virtuous cycle keep going. I've had that happen a couple of times and I've seen it happen with friends of mine, is where they've got an excellent program and their boss comes along and says, well, what good are you? What have you done for me lately? And if they don't step back every now and then and say, well, here's the value of preventing those problems, it's just, it evaporates. It becomes the expected norm. And so unless you're making incremental improvements all the time, it's hard to show the value unless you show the preventative piece of it. So part of the investments, not only in the tools and the staff and the training and so on, it also includes the visibility of those programs so that you can maintain it.
Exactly. You build that into your process. If you detect that anomaly and implement a corrective or preventative action for it, mm-hmm. you document it with the savings.
Yeah.
And that, because often those programs are one of the first things to go when things get tight, because no one's aware of what it's actually doing. They're not aware of it till it's too late. It's gone. And now you got to start from scratch again, because everyone that was part of it is gone.
That's right. Yeah. Unfortunately, I've been a part of systems that have done that and then go, oops, you know, and then they hire a bunch of hired guns to come in, or they try to outsource it to stopgap the losses. And it's just never a pretty picture. Yeah. Well, you know, it's one of those things. It's the investment in, at least in my car right now, is a spare tire in the back. And I spent the time to figure out how to get it out from underneath my car the other day. But I suspect I probably really do need to justify getting that tool set. There's going to be something I can do on that car. I better go figure out whether it's metric or not. Different scope of problem in justification, but I'll have to think through. I don't know if I'm going to get my wife to be able to sit down and do an FMEA with me or not for the home maintenance and home shop and stuff, but we'll see what I get.
If you're able to do that, let me know how.
Okay. I'll send you the notes. No, but you know, it's one of those questions that comes up every now and then, and I was thinking about it probably because I've heard a number of questions that were similar to this. What's the right stocking level? What's the right spare level? What's the right staffing level? Those kinds of questions have come across over the last couple of months. And so I'm glad we had a chance to talk about it, James. It's one of those things that it's out there, and I wasn't aware of the benchmark 3% of assets to into your maintenance program. That's pretty helpful.
Yeah. So, but if anyone has any questions on this topic or wants more information or on, you know, what are those rules of thumb for staffing levels based on, you know, size of assets, all those things, let us know. We'll, if we get enough interest, maybe we'll pull together a resource guide or something like that to help everyone out.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be awesome. That'd be great. Great idea. So speaking of that, James, let's ask our listeners that if there are questions, you know, get a hold of us at reliability.fm. You can find the various shows that we have. There's plenty of opportunity there to leave a comment or send us a question. We're also pretty visible under the about pages. You can find both of us and you can leave us messages there. But what are your questions? What topics would you like to hear about and learn more about? And that really does form the basis for this show, is the pull up a chair, join us, join the conversation and let us know what's on your mind. And we'd love to chat with you about what issues you have, what ideas you have, what suggestions you have, and make it just part of the show. So with that, James, I think we'll wrap up this one.
All right. Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.